TV comedic actor Phil Hartman is best known for his 8 brilliant seasons on Saturday Night Live, where his versatility and comedic timing resulted in some of the funniest and most famous sketches in the television show's history. He also starred as pompous radio broadcaster Bill McNeil in the NBC sitcom News Radio and voiced numerous classic roles, most memorably washed-up actor and commercial pitchman Troy McClure on Fox's long-running animated hit The Simpsons. But Hartman's seemingly charmed life was cut tragically short when he was fatally shot by his troubled third wife, Bryn, who turned a gun on herself several hours later. The shocking and headline-generating turn of events stunned those closest to the couple, as well as countless fans who knew Phil only from afar. Mike Thomas's new biography is You Might Remember Me. It is published by St. Martin's Press, and we welcome Mike to the program. Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
What brought you to the subject of Phil Hartman, and ultimately, how important was it for you to get the blessing of the family before you move forward?
Well, I mean, I've been writing about comedy for, you know, almost 2 decades. I do it a lot for the Chicago Sun-Times. My last book was about the Second City. A lot of people came out of there who went on to bigger and better things, Stephen Colbert, Bonnie Hunt, you know, Dan Aykroyd. So I've been steeped in this world for a long time. And somebody who interviewed me for my last book, he became a friend, and he emailed me one day out of the blue and said, I would love to read a book about Phil Hartman, because he knew I'd been looking for subjects. And I went, oh, my God, that's brilliant, because Phil was part of the cast when I first started watching SNL in earnest in 1986. I was about 16 years old. And, you know, that's my all-time favorite cast, of course. And so I went, wow, I know a lot about Phil's work on the show, on news radio, on The Simpsons. I know stuff about his death because I read that. I knew virtually nothing about what happened in between. And so I started putting out some feelers and making calls. And yes, it was important for me to have some of Phil's siblings and many of his close friends on board, but that was a very incremental process. It started with his oldest brother, John, and it just kind of slowly snowballed from there.
When you set out to do this project, what were the questions that you wanted to answer? What are the things that you wanted to explore?
I wanted to figure out who Phil was. I really only knew who he was from watching him on screen, and I get the impression that a lot of other people thought the same thing, because Phil tended to play a lot of bosses and straight arrow characters and squares, and he was not really that way in life. I mean, Phil was a rock roadie. He loved to smoke pot. He loved to surf. He was kind of the antithesis of a lot of these characters he played. And it was a lot of fun getting to know the real guy.
When he went into Saturday Night Live, bring us to that point of because, you know, you think of this like overnight success. But how much slogging was there to get to that point where he found his place at SNL?
You know, there was quite a bit of slogging. He spent almost 11 years with the Groundlings, you know, an improv-based troupe on Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles. And he became kind of the king of the Groundlings. He was a standout star there. And he'd always wanted to do something in comedy. He was always doing, you know, famous routines, even when he was young, Bob Newhart, Jonathan Winters. So he always had this aim. But, you know, it wasn't until the end of his Groundlings years that Lorne Michaels came to the troupe, as he did frequently, to poach some talent. And the first year he came, Lorne actually chose John Lovitz, who was a contemporary of Phil toward the end of his Groundlings tenure. It was 1985. Phil was going through a divorce at the time. He liked his cushy life in California, and he didn't want to leave for New York. Some people thought Lovitz got chosen over Phil, which actually wasn't the case, according to Lorne. Phil could have gone, but he chose not to. The next year, 1986, he got a chance to audition again in New York, and even then he had to have his arm twisted. He was still ambivalent about moving to New York and doing the show, but you know, people said, are you crazy? You have to do this. And it turned out to be the greatest move of his career.
Was his hallmark, I mean, obviously he was a very funny man, but it was the impressions, right, that put him on the radar, and ultimately, and I was looking, I guess last night, was looking at his audition reel for SNL, a lot of impression work.
Characters. He did a lot of impression work.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a great character actor. He always called himself Mr. Potato Head. He said, slap a wig on me, a little bit of makeup, and I can transform into almost anybody, and he could. and he loved to actually just inhabit these characters. He wasn't he didn't do them as caricatures. He did them as close to real as possible. He knew how their voices felt in his throat. He knew what hand motions they liked to make. He knew how they walked because he would study tapes. And he just became these characters, whether it was Sinatra or Clinton or any one of a number of characters. And yes, the impressions are especially what catapulted him at SNL.
When he got to SNL, how much of it was a perfect fit? You would think 8 years that he was in his element.
He was in his element. Phil, as he was at the Groundlings, was a tremendous ensemble player. He could play the lead, but he didn't have to all the time. He didn't have to be the wild and crazy front man all the time. He was content to play much smaller roles. And, you know, as Jan Hooks, his contemporary at SNL, told me, no matter how small the role, Phil played it for blood. He was that committed, and that's what gave him charisma on stage, or part of it anyway. She called herself and Phil the Clydesdales of their SNL cast, because they would sort of dutifully pull the wagon while a few others around them, she called them show ponies. They sort of pranced around them. And for a long time, Phil was content to be a great utility player. They called him the glue there, and he would have a stack of scripts in front of him at read-throughs because the writers knew whatever they wrote, he could make it sing.
In that making it sing, it was his presence was such that of an everyman and seemed so easygoing. And I don't know how to ask this delicately, but for a guy who's married 3 times, so what was the difficulty? Why was he a hard guy to live with?
Well, I think the difficulty was, the main difficulty was that he could become emotionally detached. I don't think he gave his mates what they wanted relationship-wise. I mean, he was a very decent guy. He wasn't a mean guy, but he could be not present. He could be in his own world. He didn't like conflict at all. You know, even his second wife, Lisa, who I love, she's great, and who actually became friends again with Phil toward the end of his life, even after they had divorced in the early 80s. She told me that Phil, you know, whenever they had conflict, he would just sort of shrink away from it, sometimes just go into the bedroom and curl up and go to sleep or pretend to go to sleep. And that's actually what he did, from all I can tell, with his third wife, Bryn, on the night he was tragically killed.
You write about this in the book, but talk a little bit about that relationship and the fact. I mean, obviously, it was a stunning turn of events. Very few people, you know, ever saw this coming. How much of, in your investigation, how long had trouble been brewing there?
There'd been trouble for years. I mean, from the start of their relationship, there was discord. They would have arguments. They would break up, get back together. You know, throughout his SNL and news radio years, there was always something going on and off. But nobody could have foreseen the violent end that Phil met. I mean, a lot of people knew there was discord in his marriage, but nobody ever thought it would lead to that incident.
What led to that incident?
You know, there was a lot of different things. I don't think anybody is ever going to be able to say definitively, but that night he was killed, they apparently had another one of their arguments. There was, after the fact, cocaine found in her blood. There was alcohol. She had begun taking an antidepressant, Zoloft, weeks before, and it was just sort of sample packs. It wasn't even prescription, so it's really not known if she knew how much she was taking. And then she was very frustrated with her career. She wanted to be an actress. You know, she didn't go anywhere as an actress. And Phil tried to help her. He couldn't really help her. And so all of that sort of came into play. I'm sure there was some jealousy. So it was probably 5, 6, 7 factors that were just toxic on that night and combined to really come to a head with that incident.
And obviously this is a troubled woman, right? I mean, there was a point where you're going to take the life of your husband and to take your own life.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, I don't know. She had been to some rehab. Phil, you know, would try to help as he could, but I got the sense that he didn't really understand. She was a recovering addict as well, I should mention that, who had apparently fallen off the wagon after 10 years of sobriety in 1997. And I got the sense that Phil didn't really understand what addiction was and how insidious and pernicious it is. And a friend of his told me an interesting thing, that Phil was so good at so many things, he was so confident. This friend said Phil thought he could pull Bryn through her addictions through the power of his personality. And that, of course, you know, was to me a poor understanding of what addiction was. And so she was dealing with that as well.
When you look at the legacy, the fact that you can write a book and have it be something that still resonates with us so many years after his tragic death speaks to that legacy and how these characters and his personality and his work has endured.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's one of the things that really struck me most when I was writing this book, is the depth of emotional attachment that fans still have for Phil. And I really have to think it goes beyond the characters he played, because a lot of them, you know, were not nice guys. Phil loved to play morons and arrogant idiots, and because he wasn't that way. But I think there was, you know, a palpable decency that somehow shone through these characters that really endeared him to people.
What has the reaction been from people from the book so far, just out? But so
I have
far.
Been utterly floored, honestly. I mean, in a good way, from his ex-wives, his brothers, his closest friends. They have all told me that I succeeded in bringing Phil accurately to life on the page. And so I was very heartened to hear that.
Well, the name of the book is You Might Remember Me, The Life and Times of Phil Hartman. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Mike Thomas is the author, a longtime arts and entertainment staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. Mike, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations on the book, and I appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, You Might Remember Me, The Life and Times of Phil Hartman, published by St. Martin's. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.